What's up, everybody? Armand here, back with another episode. Today's guest, we have Michael Stein. Michael is the founder and CEO of Abadak Inc. and Stein Media. So Michael started as a stand-up comedian when he was 19, and he needed money to fund that. So he became a nightclub promoter in LA, started a business as a nightclub promoter, and very quickly, in about 6 months, became the number one for his age bracket. This was a fascinating story, and it's a common theme, is that he uses entrepreneurship to fuel his passions. And that's exactly what he did with the next company. So he got into acting, wanted to be in more movies, and so he didn't really have the funding to make movies, so he built a business to fund his movies, which he's been running that business for the past 22 years. Such a fascinating story. We talk a lot about systems that you need to run a business that keeps going, the wheel keeps turning while you stay busy. We talk a lot about mindsets, how he writes and directs movies, the value of preparing and preparing and preparing. This was such a really, really fun episode. I enjoyed it a lot and I learned a lot. I already know a couple habits that I want to change after this episode. Thanks for listening and hope you enjoy this episode of the Play Hard Podcast.
Work hard, play hard. Work hard, play hard. Work hard, play hard. Play hard.
We can talk about that.
I mean, it's really everything else takes up so much of my time, but that is like a guilty pleasure, you know. So,
yeah, yeah. All right. Well, with that, we can get right to it. For the listener, this is Michael Stein. He's the CEO and founder of Abadak Inc. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, Abadak. That's right.
Abadak. The CEO of Stein Media, and then the founder and CEO of Off the Wall Productions back in the day. I saw you had some experience back in the... That was club promotion for Hollywood. Do you mind diving into that first? Because this is kind of like your entrepreneurial origin.
Yeah, no. Nightclub promotion was big in the late 80s. And I did stand-up when I was 19. And I was like, man, I got a lot of people here. I really need to make some money. I was broke. And I was like, I'm gonna give nightclub promotion a stab, you know. And within 6 months, it just clicked. You know, I'm a workaholic, so I love people like you and I talking here right now. So it's always been like that. So I had a lot of, you know, and within 6 months, I became the number one nightclub promoter in my age bracket, which was still, I wasn't even 21. What can you get to 21 old clubs? But I had like 16 to 23 year olds was like, you know, like I had. I didn't have the stars of Hollywood. I had all the sons and daughters of the stars in Hollywood.
Oh, I see. So I know you're big on movies. Did you see all the Marvel movies?
Yeah, I love the Marvel movies. I think they're great.
It's like that one guy who guides people to a treasure he can't possess. That was you, not being 21.
Which character was that?
They were getting one of the stones, the Soul Stone.
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy with the red face or something like that. Yeah, I just picture that you not being 21. But showing everyone how to get in. I mean, it's Hollywood. You could probably get in.
You know, what's funny? There's a little, you know, I wanted to do a 21 and over club so bad when I was 20. And back in those days, the cool promoters were like French and just the esoteric kind of guy, you know, like artsy guys. And I had this little club called Junk Mail, because you always got junk mail in those days. And like on like Mondays, it was like Monday night. That's where like all the act, like the people in the industry would go out, because I don't be seen only by other industry people. You know, so I'm gonna do a Monday night, right? And I tell Frederick, the ultimate French promoter, I said, Frederick, what do you think of my invites? You know, 21 and over club. And he's like, this is bullshit. And I'm like, why? He goes, his name's Junk Mail. Women don't want to go to a club named Shit Box. And you American promoters throwing your flyers around everywhere. I say the best promotion is no promotion. I tell them not to come, I close the doors, and they still come. And they would. And that was my lesson in, like, you know, pretentiousness. But I enjoyed those nightclub days very much. It was like 5-6 years of a nonstop, like 7 nights a week, 7 days a week going out and promoting clubs.
Yeah, that sounds intense. So you mentioned two things. Number one, after a few months, it just clicked. And number two is that you're a workaholic. Would you say that the reason it clicked is because you were just so head to the grindstone, keep going? Or was there anything that happened where you were like, oh, I got the hang of this. Let's dive in.
My dad, I would always force me to be around, you know, all kinds of people when I was a kid. So I got used to being like, dad, I just want to be with you alone. But he's like, nah, I got friends. You know, he was divorced from my mom. And it was a really weird childhood. So I got used to being around a lot of people. And he would talk to anybody. He would become friends with somebody, best friends with somebody. He was like a cross between Elvis and Santa Claus. He looked like Elvis. He you know, he was always jolly. He was having a good time. You know, he'd get home at like 3 o'clock in the morning because he didn't know how to say turn off. So I grew up with that environment, you know, of like, you know, just, you know, meeting people doesn't turn off. And I really enjoy people. So, plus I didn't know this when I was an adult, but I got the ADHD. So it's like constant, you know, you do things to the extreme that you're really into. Mm-hmm. So I just got lost. I was like, I'm just going to do this, you know, be the best. And you know, I was kind of a basket case as a kid. So when I started, you know, I wasn't used to winning in the beginning. So when you found something that you were successful at, you really hunkered down on it because it was like, oh, it's like fire, you know? So I kept on going and I was pretty hyper about it.
Yeah, that's wow, that sounds fascinating. I'm like so curious. I almost want to skip everything and just talk about your psychology and like how this happened. But at the same time, we got some companies to talk about.
Sure.
So now you evolved. So these company, you were doing this nightclub promotion, and then what shifted from that to what was like the next phase of your career? Is this when you went into acting?
Yeah, well, because of the club promotion, I got to meet a lot of people. You know, it really forced me in a lot of doors. So I didn't know it, but my girlfriend, you know, at the time, her dad was Peter Guber, and I wanted to be an actor and a filmmaker and an entrepreneur. And Peter Guber at the time was the most powerful man in Hollywood. I remember a year before that, my friend was in a movie, Bradley Craig. He was in a movie called Stand By Me. He had a pretty good part. And I was like saying, you know,
like the well-known Stand By Me with the train tracks and all that.
Yeah. Bradley Craig. Yeah. He was Keith or Sutherland's right-hand man. We went to high school together. I'm looking at him. I'm like, dude, if I can get to know these people in the credits, I could definitely, you know, get a job in Hollywood because I'm talented. You know, I believed in myself, you know? And then I, you know, like before even I promoted clubs, as I was promoting my first club, I was on a film set. I was as an extra. It was the first time I'd been on a film set, and I spent 3 days on it. And I was promoting the club to all these, it was a huge party scene up in Beverly Hills, 500 people. And I was hanging out with this good looking guy for like 3 days. He was an extra and I was an extra. I was like, ooh, and he had portfolio pictures and everything. Super nice guy. And it turned out to be Brad Pitt. Later, you know, a couple movies later.
No, I was like, oh,
so there's one guy I met right there. And then I stumble upon my girlfriend's dad as Peter Guber. You know, then they want to help me out. And I'm like, I'm a nightclub promoter, but I do want to be an actor, but I love this girl so much. I didn't want to accept any help. So then my girlfriend's sister had a boyfriend. His name was Paul Anderson. Now Paul Thomas Anderson. So he didn't have a car. He's like, I need to get somebody to drive me home. You know, he's 17. I was like 20. He's like, can somebody drive me home? I said, I'll drive you home. So I had him rolling and like, you know, I was on his roll. I already did stand up at this point. And you know, when somebody laughs at your joke, when you just stand up, you just like feed the fire. I'm hyper again,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Nonstop. 2 days later, he calls him up. He's like, I got an idea for a short film. I want to play this porno actor. I'm like, I'm in. I went over to the house. We had like a make-believe production meeting, you know, and we made some other films. And like 6 months later, he did the Dirt Diggler story. I played Dirt Diggler,
yeah.
Which is the short film, The Boogie Nights, which I appear in as well. And that opened up more doors. And I, you know, got to, you know, see what he started to do. And I was like, I could become a filmmaker and put myself in the, you know, that's how I could become an actor. I'll become a filmmaker and put myself in my own shit. And I did that. And it was a long haul. I wrote, directed, and produced an award-winning short film, got me close to a movie deal, got bought by HBO, won some of the largest short film festivals in the world, Palm Springs and Oberhausen, but no movie deal, you know, after a lot of, you know, close, but no cigar. I said, fuck this, man. I was like, I stopped promoting Client Clubs because I went all in on being a filmmaker. And that, you know, I said, I'm going to make my own movie, but I was broken in debt. And this is like, you know, over a period of like 6-7 years, you know, because it was, I worked as a production assistant and I was, you know, off and on still promoting clubs. I was just busy, you know, and that was my education, you know, working in production. So I said, I'm going to make my own movie, the movie that no one would ever let me make. And I wrote several screenplays at the time, but one of the screenplays I wrote was called Love Hollywood Style, about four intertwining stories about dysfunctionality of love in Hollywood. You know, crazy.
Something you knew well as a nightclub promoter.
That's right. Yeah. It was just like
right, Faye Dunaway. You know, they say.
Yeah, I didn't have any money though, so I started the company that I have now, and I made within 6 months I made like $300,000. Within like a year, I made over $500,000 in my first year of the company. And I was like, great, I'm gonna make my own movie now. So we casted Faye Dunaway, 2-time Academy Award winner Faye Dunaway, to play the role of God. It was important for us to have her play a role that she felt like she truly knew. And we casted Andy Dick to play a porno director in our movie. And if you know what's going on with Andy Dick lately, it seems like we're typecasting. And we casted Coolio, the rapper, to play himself.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace. And in retrospect, as we look back, who would have thought the nicest one out of those three would have been the gangster rapper? So I did that film, did decently in film festivals, but didn't make my money back. And since then, I said, you know what? I'm going to make this business that I started, you know, successful. I'm not going to squander it, because I almost bottomed it out, spent so much money on the film. And, you know, it was crazy. I was a crazy
guy.
Was this
Abadak or Stein Media?
It was tarpsplus.com, selling tarps on the internet.
Wow. So this is really interesting. So you became an entrepreneur not because of the entrepreneurial side. You did it to fuel your passions. You did it as like a means to an end versus this is what you want to do. That's fascinating. That's the sign of a resourceful person who said, I need money. How do I get it?
I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, but really I did it because I'm like, I want to make a movie because I so badly wanted to. I was so tired of like you get the money, we'll get the talent. You get the talent, we'll get the money. And back and forth. That's like purgatory in Hollywood. So I was like, screw it. So then, but I almost bottomed it out, you know, with so much volatility.
Yeah.
So, but since then it's made over $100 million. It's made well over that. And it continues to grow. And next, in about 4 months from now, we're launching, and we've been planning this for a couple of years. We're launching a branded, patented product, line of products. And that's going to be another outdoor company that Abadak Inc. is my incorporation. It's just a technical name, and it owns Tarps Plus technically. And Bolator, which is this new brand, will hopefully be like the next Yeti, and you'll hear about it and be a household thing and the next lifestyle brand. As I see the Tom Ferriss book behind you, you know, all my tricks and everything I've learned out throughout the years of like, you know, leveraging and processes and maximizing, everything. And then that's what's happening with me right now.
So I looked at the main thing that you guys do is you create tarps and canopies, and I love the work and play part. That's this podcast, Play Hard Podcast. But it's for work and play. So how, I feel like so many people, their entire life is encompassed with the business, and you are able to have the business help, but like you also do stand-up comedy, you also are an actor, and you're running Stein Media. So what are you doing in the business, and what are you kind of like delegate? I imagine it's a lot of delegation and having people run things for you. Like, how did you get to that point? How, like, what are you doing there?
Dude, that is such a great question, because I talked about this, you know, I was like, how do you find time to do that? First of all, I've been doing this for 22 years, this business. So that's the hardest part of anything is in the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the culmination of me doing massive amount of like personal development work, which I started when I was in my early 20s. You know, even though I don't, you know, I'm not in film right now, everything else, writing 8 screenplays, you know, that helps with me writing, you know, so everything's like a fast process for me because of all the failures and successes I've had leading up to this point. And then I have something that I just had an acronym for the other day. I was just talking to somebody. I was like, cause I haven't done stand-up in a while. And I'm starting to do it because it's actually going to help me with something that I've been wanting to start up again. Cause I always knew I was going to go back to do that. It's a lifestyle for me. But I said, how can I make sure that it works with everything else that I'm doing? So I decided there's a plan to that, but you know, the acronym that I came up with is PLAY. It's processes, leveraging, and automation. Processing, leverage, automation, and I don't know, I forgot the other one. But anyways,
those are the three important ones.
There was a Y in there. Anyways, the processing and automation, and whatever you can't, you try not to do whatever you have to do yourself. You got to learn it all on your own, and then you have to create a process, and then you have to create an automation. Oh, pay. That was it. Pay. Processing Automations and or PAL. I'm sorry, that's it. That's the PAL. Processing Automations and Leveraging. PAL.
We got it.
So this is fresh off the block. I just was talking about this with somebody the other day. And you take that to the nth degree. My friend, name drop, got a sore throat. Actually do, if you can't hear it. got a name drop. Davin Michaels. He wrote a New York Times bestselling book called Outsource Smart. He's awesome.
Throw that in the show notes. Help promote.
Yeah. So I try to really adopt a lot of what he does. And it's a lot of what Tim Ferriss's book talks about in the 4-Hour Work Week. And really, you know, you need to really say, how can I cut the fat off of this? Hmm. What is the shortest distance? How can I speed up so, you know, as fast as I can and create a process and an automation and then leverage it? So if I don't do PAL first, then I'm going to have to do that shit, which is fine. You know, and then you have higher priorities, and that is, and then also net time or multitasking X, which is like, basically, if I have to work out and I got to spend time with my daughter, let's work out together, you know, or something like that. Now I can do three things. If I got to watch a documentary on something and I got to work out and I got to spend time with my daughter, that's multitasking 2X.
Have you read Atomic Habits?
No.
That's a lot like the concept James Clear talks about, habit stacking, where like habits can just pile up on top of each other, and you try to just be more efficient with your routines. Like if you're used to doing one thing and something else can be added with it. Like one thing I was thinking of recently is I've been having a tough time carving out the time for, you know, journaling out my finances. And I feel like when I'm at the gym, one thing I have a lot of is downtime in between sets. So one thing I can do is in between sets, just start like writing down all the stuff that I buy, like from card to my Excel sheet. And then I think like, okay, a little downside would be, instead of typing on my computer, it's my little ass phone, but I don't give a fuck. Like if it's saving me time, then that's kind of my solution. But that's an example of habit stacking. You're
right.
Putting together.
That's
things.
Perfectly put. That's right. There's so much time in the day. You got to suck. Depends on what you want. I mean, you know, but I want to do a lot of shit. And then I'll also figure out what one thing can help the other thing. So for example, I got to go to trade shows when I launch Bolitor. Well, also, what am I going to do at night? If I'm going to travel out to Vegas or I'm going to go to another part of the country, why not do some stand up? Why not? You know?
Yeah. Check out open mics and just do some gigs out there. Yeah, that's sick.
Why not wear a Bolitor shirt when I ever do stand up, and why not post that on TikTok? And every time I wear a Bolitor, the Bolitor symbol, be like, I can't keep on seeing that, you know, and then you're tagging that, you're hashtagging. Like, there's more. There's a lot more that I can make a list of. And how can you make the things that you want to do work with the other things that you really need to do? And there's first priorities.
Oh, and I bet trade shows give you a shit ton of material too.
I haven't been in a trade show in a long time because I sell a Me Too product now with Tarsh Plus. With Bolitor, it's a branded product, so it's a whole new – everything's difficult in the beginning. So the end of 2023 and 2024 is going to be very challenging for me, very busy, but I know what it's going to take, because whenever you start something in the beginning – because you said, how do you find time to do this? Because I've been doing something for 22 years, TarshPlus.com and Abadak Inc. and all that is like turnkey. I mean, I got everything in place. It's a system.
Yeah.
You know, and even when something falls out of place, there's not a lot of volatility because it's plug and play, especially with, you know, virtual assistants and everything, you know, that's really easy. The hiring and firing is, I hire really well now. Also, that's another thing. HR, man, you got to pay your people right. You got to get insurance. You got to make sure that they're taken care of, so they never think about leaving you, because training people is a waste of fucking time. It's always time.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what are some tips you have for hiring well?
Look at how long they've been at the last job. Look at how old they are and how long they've been at the last jobs. Background checks. You know, I really don't go on education so much. Depends on what you're hiring for. You know, if it's specialized, you know, if it's, you know, a purchasing manager or something, you know, or, you know, a project manager. Yeah, maybe we'll look into, you know, the education is important, but it's all important. Everything's important, but it's the longevity of the person, because of, it's like a relationship, you know, how the girlfriend, well, I have a wife, you know, and she's great, but she had good relationships before me. I wanted to hear about her past relationships. I was like, I'm done with this shit. Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Venus, Mars in the Bedroom, all kinds of, like, you know, relationship books. I made the list, what I want, what I don't want. I don't want to waste my time anymore with people that weren't right. So it's the same thing with hiring. What's their background like? How long they've been in the prior relationships, businesses. And then you got to interview and track it well. And then, usually that's the hardest part. The hardest part is in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, that makes sense. So you said there at 2023, 2024, there's a tough time coming. And I think it's super important. I mean, respect the hell out of the fact that you're aware of that. Not a lot of people are aware they're in the midst of a tough time or something's coming. But then you've also mentioned you did a lot of personal work in your early 20s. So what tools have you learned apart from just awareness, basic awareness? Like, what have you learned to manage that, maybe the mental health side of that tough time coming or your own set of routines?
Tony Robbins done everything he's ever done, been in Mali and Fiji and all that. So he's like my number one guy, but I've done other, Zig Ziglar and all the guys, all Jim Rohn. NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. But Tony Robbins will talk about six human need psychology. That was a big eye opener at a young guy, So you're like, why do people do what they do? Why do I do what I do? Why did I compromise integrity with that person? Why did they do it with me? As you start to understand six human need psychology, which is, certainty, uncertainty, significance, love, contribution, and growth. Everybody does everything for, those reasons, how they get those things, whether it's, good decisions or bad decisions or vehicles, how they choose to get those things. It's a whole different story. But once I started to understand that, it helped me with everything, helped me with business, helped me with stand-up comedy, writing, everything, because, screenplays are based on character. Characters are plot, plots character. So, why people do what they do, helped me with that process. And then the triad of emotions, which is physiology, focus, and your words. Basically, how you feel throughout the day is a recipe. So there's a recipe, and also this helps with acting. Eric Morris, who's a very big sense memory disciple of Lee Strasberg, is a recipe. So sense memory, just like the triad of emotions, your vocabulary, how you visualize things, what you say internally and externally, and your physiology, your facial muscles, mm-hmm. your posture, it all has to do with what are you trying to do? You're trying to be powerful. You're trying to be emotional. You're trying to be vulnerable. You're trying to be whatever you're trying to do. It's important for you to be congruent with what you're trying to accomplish. That helps with whether you got to walk on stage in 2 seconds or whether you have to get ready to go in a meeting and let's say, hey, look, I need to do X, Y, and Z this meeting, or I need to be in this emotional state over, over the next 6 months because this is what I need to do. So, and I need to be able to work really hard, or it's like, I don't want to read this another book. I don't want to do that. Well, I don't want to write right now. You have to get an emotional state so you can do that.
Yeah.
And then it gets easier. Everything's harder in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
It gets easier as you do this. It gets you into your nervous system. It becomes Pavlov conditioning. So those things really helped personal development. And there's many, 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 many more, but there's things, but those tools were essential in getting this in my nervous system and taking action immediately and following through with things.
And that's 60 Minute Psychology, you said?
Six Human Need Psychology.
Oh, Six Human Need. Okay.
Yeah,
Six
people Human have Need these, Psychology. Yeah. It's not an exact science, but it's almost a perfect art form of like why people do what they do. For instance, men are significant. There's primaries from women are a little more connection and love driven, but certainty, uncertainty, significance, love, contribution, and growth. We do the things for those reasons. Well, why do people join gangs? They do it to get significance and certainty, to feel safe. To feel uncertain is variety. Anything can happen at any day.
Yeah.
Grow. I'm growing up the ranks. Contribution. I'm supporting my peer group.
Yeah.
There's good vehicles and bad vehicles, but this could all be applied towards anything. But understanding that really helped me, move forward quite a bit.
Yeah. And I mean, the fact that it's not a perfect science is totally okay. One that I've kind of looked at, I had this recent philosophical debate in my head. So, the Myers-Briggs personality test, how it's not proven in science at all. But yeah. The way I see it, when I meet new people, I try to see them as uncharted land. You're an adventurer stepping foot somewhere you've never been before. I'd rather go with a shitty map than no map at all.
Right.
That's nice. That's just kind of how I see it.
That's the Armando Uno aphorism right there. I'd rather go with a shitty map than no map at all. Yeah. I like that. You ought
to, I'll put it on a t-shirt somewhere. For the show.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
all right. So you have these. So let's say, okay, you were talking about you got next 6 months, you have to be in a certain mental state or do things a certain way. Do you have like daily systems in process for your life that help you keep up with that? What are they?
Yeah, I learned that I had, first of all, I don't believe ADHD is a exact science either, but I started to look at similar traits because I worked with somebody that's like a 1% of 1% of Mensa and they said, you got ADHD. And I was like, eh, I don't, screw you. I was like, well, is that such a bad thing? That picture of this guy right here, Albert Einstein, he had ADHD. I'm like, okay, good. I'm in good company. Michael Jordan had that.
Over there.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. You got him too. Yeah. Hey, look, if you're going to believe bullshit, you know, might as well believe some good shit. So I'm like, all right, I'm Albert Einstein. I got a little bit of that. My last name is Stein. So let's believe some all this shit. So, but what processes though, I got to keep it simple. K-I-S-S, keep it super simple. So my processes are very routine oriented because I can get stray. So whenever I learn a new process, I'm like, I ask myself the first question, how can I make this fit in my everyday life? How can I make this stay with staying power? Because we've all done something like, this is going to be it, man. I got a new organizer. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to be this guy now. And then you like, it doesn't happen. Well, I try to avoid those because those are like roads that you go down. So I'm like, okay, I got to keep it simple. This is what I do every day. I put a process in place and I'm desperately trying to fit it in forever, you know, or however long that project is going to take to fit in with everything else I'm doing. How I'm doing it, constantly adjusting and spending time. So look, okay, now I'm going to try this at this time of day. I'm this time, but I try to keep things super simple.
So for you setting like your habits evolve with each project or phase of time that you have, and you try to make them as bare bones and simple as possible.
Yeah. And I try to over prepare, which takes time, but I try to punch through the target. And every time I've done that, I've done well, especially because I can get distracted easily. Yeah. So I make sure I stay on point, keep it simple, and prepare way in advance. Because it's like, well, you should have started already. And some people say, you know, just start. It's the most important thing. I will backdate, you know, like for the product launch. We've already exceeded that, not because of me, but because of China. But I'm already kind of preparing from like, well, why did you order that service like way in advance? I'm like, because I don't want to learn. I don't want to take the extra day and a half, even though a day and a half is a small amount of time to learn Asana or Gorgeous, which is a CRM type of, you know, program. I don't want to do that. It's like, well, you're paying, you know, an extra 6 months on that. I don't care. And that's pennies on the dollar. I mean, that's who cares? That I'm learning the process now, so I'm avoiding this later.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm doing everything way in advance. Every time I did a film, or you know, you get ready for a big, you know, a set on you're doing stand up. If you prepare, then you get to set it and then forget it a little bit. Now you're more fluid because how you plan the business and how you plan, let's say, a 20-minute comedy set. It's a probable show. It's not your set. You got to have the most important thing is the rapport with the audience. The most important thing is when you launch this product is your rapport with your clientele. You have a probable product. It's going to be a probable set.
Yeah.
Right. But you got to be able to shift. So I hone it really hard. I prepare it really hard. And I learned that the hard way many, many years now that you have to over prepare and then you get to set it and kind of forget it so you can stay fluid.
Can you give an example of over-preparing? Maybe, let's use stand-up comedy instead of business, something totally different. I don't understand. Like, I don't know. It's not something I've tried before. So what, like, how does that work? You got a 20-minute set. How would you over-prepare for that?
Well, I there's no such thing as over-preparing, I don't think. I think it's, you know, just preparing. I guess you could call it over-preparing. I hate to say that, I guess. It's just prepare. There's no such a thing as over-preparing, right? So, how would you prepare for a 20-minute set? So you have, what do I want to talk about? Where am I going to be performing? Who am I going to be talking about? What's the avatar of the customer? That's back to business, right? Know the who, what, where, why, when, and how of what you're dealing with. So you walk in. So that all, then you start to say, well, I have set material that I've already done, or now I'm going to write new material. Where does that fit into the story? I like to tell a story. Every comedian's different. Some people just tell jokes. You know, one-liner. I tell stories that are with fat cut out of it, with premises and punchlines, you know. So my laughs per minute LPMs are as much as possible.
Yeah.
So I will sit, you know, sit there and I'll write, you know, and as I'm doing it, I'll take the unfinished set, and I have a saloon on my property. I have a 10-acre property out here in Texas. Sounds crazy, but I built a saloon, and there's a stage with a mic and a stool and a neon sign says Joker's Club. It's something I've had for a while, you know. I've had people over, and I'll go on stage and I'll say, look, I'm just going to do, you know, and I have bistro tables and chairs there, and I will do gestalt therapy, you know, which is where you talk to imaginary people.
Yeah.
You talk to, you know, and I'll riff, I'll do my set, you know, and that's called, it's an actual rehearsing process. I'll come up with material that way, tap on my iPhone. Oh, that's a good tag. That's a good tag for that joke. You know what tagging is? It's where you set your premise and then you have a punchline, and then you got a nice little thing that you could say that about that, because you've already established what the premise is. Now it's tag, 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 tag. Hmm. So, you know, and I'll do that. You know, I work out every day, and I don't want to brag, but I got a gym. So this is my routine. I got a gym. It's a separate building in the property. I go work out in the gym, and then about 50 yards from the gym, past the barn, is the saloon. I will walk from, so my routine now, I made a routine. So Mike, you're sweating, go when you're in state. This is the state I want to be in. And the time of day, usually when I'll be performing, 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30 at night, go from the gym, go on stage, and I'll do 20 minutes. And of some material that I want to do. And you kind of forget, I want to tap on my notes. Oh yeah, let's go back to that.
Yeah.
And then I do that, and I'll write during the day, you know, first comes first, my business. That's what's paying for all this fun.
You know, I'm starting this over, this plan, prepare. It's starting to click in my head. So I said, I've never done stand-up comedy. There was one time, I guess I wouldn't call it official, but so here's the premise is my brothers are musicians, and they were putting on a concert at my friend's house. So my friends built a stage, they put it up, they decorated the whole house. Like, it was going to be sick. We were having people come through, and they were just going to perform. And before that, I had planned I was going to do a quick comedy set. Just, I've never done it before, but I have this big love for public speaking, similarly to you talking to people. That's my thing. So I was like, comedy's a part of that. Let's see if I can do it. I just wanted to know if I could do it. Like, really, honestly, that's what I did. And so for an entire month before this show, my brothers and I practiced every single night exactly what we were going to do. I practiced my routine. They practiced their routine. Sometimes they wouldn't even, like, say the words because they would save their voice. Sometimes they, like, we just tried so many different things. One night, I told my brothers, I want you to heckle me everything I say. Another night, I was like, stay dead silent. Another night, I was like, cheer me on. Like, I just wanted to see all the different options. And dude, it was fucking tough. Like, it was so hard. But when I went up there, I'll never forget this. Half the room, which were my friends, were fucking dying. Like, they thought it was hilarious because a lot of my jokes, easy wins, just roasting them. The other half was like people not really in my friend group, so they didn't get it. And I remember at one point, some girl was like, saying, boo, we want the music. And I completely tuned her out and only focused on my friends because I like analyzed it after. I wasn't thinking in the moment. In the moment, I was just on. I was in a different mode. But after, I was like, oh, I remember when my brothers did that. I remember when they heckled me. Let me focus on the people laughing. And then a lot of people came up to me and were like, dude, that was fucking great. And I just like didn't care about the side that didn't care. Like, it was this is like unlocked a memory of that's a great, like, over-preparing really does work.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I want to respond to that. But also, I will tell you this little picture of the Whiskey Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard. I was 20 years old. I did stand up when I was 19. And a friend of mine, he was performing at a band on Sunset. And he goes, we want you. I just started promoting iClub. So I guess he's like,
yeah,
you know, Mike's pop or you know, yeah, introduce us. And I'm like, great. I don't have to wait in line. I'm going to do a set. Dude, that's such a big mistake. It is such a hard gear to perform yeah, for somebody. It's like, we want to see the band. They said the same thing to me. Dude, want to see the band. You know what I want to do this for? I was like, I had somebody come on stage, my friend Michael Rosenberg. He's like, I think they want to see the band now. And I was like, oh, shit. Everyone's like, yay, you know, like, get off the stage and put it on the band, you know? And I was like, you know what? You got to own your losses just as much as your successes. Yeah. And I was like, I got escorted off somewhat. I got asked to get off stage at the Whiskey Go-Go on Sunset. That's a badge I wear with honor.
Yeah, that is pretty sweet.
Back to the honing thing. Look, man, if you knew, you start to learn how to write, you start writing every day, you know, time plus effort will equal probable success, you know? So, you know, it's not guaranteed, but you're most likely going to get the result you want. Time plus effort. And you don't have to do like, I'm going to practice for 7 hours tonight. That's bullshit. Do it every day, a little bit every day.
Yeah.
And then chip away at it. My dad would say he never finished the eighth grade, but he became a multimillionaire only to lose it all. But he was like, chip away day to day. You know, so simple.
I like that.
But it's so real, you know, and it works.
And something to be said, I'm curious what your thoughts on this were or are, but to me, when I look back, my favorite part about all this were the nights I spent with my brothers practicing, like actually shaping it and getting it together versus the night itself, don't get me wrong, was sweet. But also it was like the process of getting better at this thing I'd never done. Like if you were to see, I recorded myself every night too. If you were to see the day one recording versus 30, like massive difference. So what are your thoughts
That's
on that?
Smart stuff. I think it's super smart. Just listen to that. It reminds me of like Julian Edelman and his dad. You know, I don't know if you know the story with Julian Edelman, the wide receiver of the Patriots.
Super Bowl MVP right there.
Super Bowl MVP, man. And his dad's like, all right, you're catching really well. Let's tie one arm behind your back, you know, and you can only use one hand, you know, and then let's throw distractions at him, you know. And it's like the more that you do that, the better you're going to get. And I think, I don't know what it is, man. I think you're young, but I think that, I don't know. I see that you used to be done a lot in the 80s and the 90s, you know, before the internet. And it's like people took pride in like these hard, weird processes, you know, maybe because they grew up in Rocky, you know, and seeing somebody struggle and then succeed. Rocky's a bit of influence for me, but I think there's some romanticism involved with putting yourself through that process, and it pays dividends in the end.
Yeah, I totally agree. Another example that comes to mind, another like true excellence is Tiger Woods. His dad was apparently former Special Forces. I think he was Green Beret. I'm not too sure, but he was definitely in the Special Forces. And what he would do to Tiger is like he would just make as much noises in the moments where he needed the most focus. Like he would freak him out, like just boo him, like banging pots and pans when he'd be putting, like he would just do all these things to psych him out until he ingrained that like the outside world doesn't matter when you're doing this. Like just hit it. And that's a weird process, but man, did it work.
I agree, man. I think it's insane, you know, hearing what you did and you know, look, you know, whatever you're trying to do, it's like, that's just part of the process. You're going to have to do a little bit every day. Don't let it walk away from your nervous system. Whatever project you're working on, you got to do something every day. Tony Robbins always talks about also in the beginning, if you truly want to do something, let's say you say, you know, my goal is to own a Mercedes-Benz. This is like a 1989, 1990 Tony Robbins thing from his old, you know, audio tapes. But he's like, look, if you want to own a Mercedes, well, to motivate you, do something immediate. It's like, what can I do to get, you know, well, I don't know, go to dealership and get a brochure to like motivate you, do some kind of action and do something every day towards getting what you want. Because you know, the more you work at it, you know, a little bit doesn't have to be, you know, big chunks. It's you bite one little piece of the elephant in the time, you'll get there.
Yeah. It's kind of like training for marathon. You don't really do sprints all the time. You know, you're going to take it easy and grow. You're going to build on that. You're going to start. I mean, I'm not currently, you know, in that state. So I can't say I could do 26 all in one go. But if I were to start training, I wouldn't start with like doing 13 miles on my first run and then getting injured. I would probably go 2 miles and then build from there.
Yeah, it's not sexy, but you know, just hearing what you did instinctively to do stand up, you know, when your brothers are performing and asking them this night, I'm going to do this night, I'm going to do that. I've done the same shit, you know, like I do a comedy writing class with my friend, Greg Dean. He's like my mentor, and he's number one comedy writing coach in LA, probably in the world. He's written several books. And, in his class one night, this is like years ago. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go do mix. I was taking Eric Morris, who was an acting teacher, and I'm going to mix the two totally the things and do like an impulsivity and just look at everybody. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to kind of just look at them and comment on them very calmly in the moment. And then just like anything, and just be observant, anything in the room, which is really weird, but it kind of metastasized in this weird, you know, kind of thing. And I was like, I never done that with a group of people where I'm like, you know, zero sensory, zero sensor, you know, to where, you know, I'm thinking it, I'm saying it.
Oh yeah. Was that at all scary? Cause I feel like sometimes I'd be worried about like the shit, if there's some shit pops in my head, I'm like, God damn, did I really just say that?
It was pretty intense but you know, you're in LA, you know, you're in with people that want to be stand-up comedians. They're like, you know, plus also, you know, I was so used to doing it in Eric Morris, cause that's an exercise that you do in an acting class, which is a really, but you're not obligated to be funny. But I'm thinking, you know, the anatomy of a joke is a premise. It's a punchline. In the middle of that is a shattered assumption with a negative denominator. So I'm looking at somebody and I'm thinking something about them. I have to think about what's negative and I have to assume something that everybody would assume about them and then come up with an outcome that no one would suspect with a negative denominator, but I'm thinking about that with impulsivity.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, and which was like really wild, but it came out to be like a really interesting thing that I, you know, and I was like, maybe only 10% of this could be applied in a routine. It was what a wonderful exercise. And it actually, I think those kind of things that span you as an artist.
Yeah. And I'm willing to bet that while that's not going to be your entire routine, I bet that flexed a muscle on crowd work and just like being in the moment, which is something that I think all comedians should have in their, all great ones have it in their tool belt, is to be able to roll with the punches and whatever comes up. Cause I can't imagine. So I play in a band and no gig we have is ever the same. We play the same set list a lot of time. No gig we've ever played is the same. And I imagine the same is for a comedian. You're not going to have the same crowd, the same venue, things like that.
Yeah, you asked about personal development, and there's something, you know, empowering questions. Now, when something shitty happens, like you get in a car accident and you sprain your leg or whatever, you bust your leg or whatever, you know, you're going to say, fuck, this sucks, you know, and you're going to be bummed out for like a certain amount of time. But I would shorten that time, deal with it, don't mask it. But then you ask yourself, what can I learn from this? What's great about this? What's funny about this? Those are empowering questions. How can I use this? Every type of situation I'm in, you know, I mean, I got stuck in Connecticut where my wife is, and we were out there with the family. We got stuck out there 5 times in a snowstorm, back and forth to the airport, back and forth 5 times. I don't drink, but I tell her dad, who drinks highballs, I'm like, let's go to your favorite restaurant and get highball. How can we like make, you know, like do something? What can I gain out of this situation? Cause I'm definitely not winning the other way, you know? So, that's empowering questions are another powerful thing.
Agreed. And so you said you don't drink. Are there any habits you've removed in your life that has helped lead towards your success? I'm guessing alcohol might be one.
Well, the very first one when you're in high school, you know, I was a terrible student, you know, the success I had at that point, other than making people laugh when I was in grade school, that was like my first, but that was just me being a weird moron, you know, but people laughed at me. So I was like, well, I'm good at that. But then I became, when I saw the movie Rocky when I was 11 years old, I became extremely like, here's a guy like me, you know, he doesn't succeed a lot, but he keeps on getting back up. He's funny. He's not smart, but he keeps on trying. The only difference between him and me is that he was physically fit. So since I was like 11 to like 16, I was like just worked out every day. And by the time I was 16, I became a physical fitness trainer. But I would come home from school, watch Pumping Iron, watch Rocky, you know, go work out. I was lazy. I didn't work. I didn't do my schoolwork. I'm like, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. When I'm 18 years old, the day that I graduated high school, I'm going to start a business, which I did and failed miserably. But it was all like, I'm just going to do what my dad does. You know, I don't see him like spreadsheeting shit out, you know, and like, you know, doing this organizing. He just gets on the phone and, you know, he's a sales animal.
Yeah.
I didn't have that acumen, you know, but I was lazy. So I got rid of laziness. You know, you build a routine, you build habits, you condition yourself towards, you know, something. You know, I would throw up now if I stayed home on a Tuesday, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and put on Wheel of Fortune. I would like literally vomit. That would like make me feel like shit.
Yeah.
You know, so, but that's because of conditioning. So those are the habits. Now, just recently, you know, intermittent fasting 5 days a week, that's been a game changer, you know, so much more energy, so much more health. You know, just little things along the way, you know, you pick up, you know, certain constantly sculpting, you know, like, you know, habits and everything, you know, but, those are some, you know, diet things, you know, how I eat, you know, every year that I get older, you know, I want to look younger as an older person. So, I try to, you know, feel good and look good as best I can. So intermittent fasting, drink a glass of water every morning as soon as I wake up. So hydration all throughout the day, you know, certain, you know, a lot of health, a lot of, you know, mental, you know, health, and, just constantly tweaking it, you know, always, you know, looking for a little tiny edge.
And then you also mentioned before the show, you got some big American bullies. When do you find time to hang out with those two?
Well, we got 10 acres out here, you know, now I went from 10,000 square feet in LA. I moved out to Texas 13 years ago, went from Woodland.
Oh, so you beat the rush, huh?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's so weird. Cause like I'm from Encino. Four people from Encino moved out here to Austin, Texas, that I grew up with, like a mile from my house.
Yeah, I was going to ask what part. So you're truly in California too, when everyone just in the pandemic decided, let's go to Austin.
Yeah, no, shit, that was way before the pandemic. It was 13 years ago I came out here, got 10 acres. American bullies have a lot of, you know, I've always had pit bulls. First day I moved out of my parents' house, I got a pit bull. American bullies, the XL bullies are like, I guess it's funny because it's not so much of a hobby. It's just the dogs that I choose, but it's like, I guess I don't have any, all my hobbies are like built into like, you know, my life, you know, like stand-up comedy you could say is a hobby, but actually I have plans for that to actually finally, after all these years, to really have substantial plans for that.
I mean, you know, to go on the stacking thing, while it's a hobby, you're already planning on your marketing tour with stand-up comedy for your product launch. So something to be said about that. You're really good at turning even the fun things that you like to do to fulfill you into opportunities that will help further you and grow you.
Yeah. For example, the American Bullies, we have a drinkware product. So we have, you know, like Yeti has a drinkware bowl, mm-hmm. you know, dog bowl.
Yeah.
We got our own brand of dog bowl, you know, so I'm going to go to, we're going to do some video shoot at some dog shows, you know, with these big industrial, you know, heavy duty bowls, yeah. these big 200 pound dogs, you know, and I'll be wearing the Bolatori shirt, you know, and all that. And I, who knows, maybe if it's far enough away, I might do stand up at the place there that night. But you know, you don't want to go crazy. There's other things I want to do. Like I'd love to go off and make a movie right now, but that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
I mean, everything shuts down if you want to make a film.
Focus time. Like one thing I'm slowly starting to realize is I too am someone who has to do so many different things at the same time. Like I have my normal job, this podcast, I've been writing a book, and then I'm in a band, so that takes a shit ton of time. Like there's so many things, and I'm realizing sometimes it's like what needs the most of my attention today or this week or this month? Like I'm starting to learn. I'm getting much better at that balance, but there are certain endeavors that I want to take on that I'm like, I can't do that right now. Not from a capacity, like from a capacity standpoint, that will require everything. Like I would have to turn all four of these off to do this one. And I don't know if that's the case right now. So would you say that's something similar with like making a movie where it just requires all hands on deck?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a huge time suck. Everything else would get sucked away, and the film is the sole thing. That's why I haven't made a film in a long time, because you just can't. I did Love Hollywood Style was the last film I made in 2006, and that totally making a movie. If I was going to make a movie, you know, it's going to be a good movie. That's going to require nothing else.
Yeah.
That is it. I mean, to shot list, shot composition, to like your shooting script, to you know, you're directing it and everything. I mean, we're talking an amazing amount of work, you know, as to where there's no way I can build that into all the other things I'm doing.
Yeah.
The other things are flexible. Priority number one is my business, because that makes all the magic happen. So, but I have figured out a way that I can do these other things. But if there's an emergency, you got to, you know, other things sacrifice, go back to that. But there's not really so much of emergency. The things I'm saying, oh my God, I could, you know, I spreadsheet out shit out now, you know, I'm like, okay, dates here. This is what's going on. Here's what works with this. You know, when I do stand up again, and I don't intend to stop because I've done it off and on since I'm 19. I'm like, Mike, well, you start again. The goal is don't stop. You know, I'll be able to like Dick Shawn, who was like in the 60s, he was a comedian. He died on stage. That'll be me. I'll be like, ugh, you know, like that's the way I want to go. So, you plan these things out to where they're successful. Now you don't have to, you know, but I want to make each one of these endeavors very successful.
And so, I noticed you're still acting, right? I saw you were an extra in La La Land.
No, I wasn't. Oh, really? I actually, that's IMDb.
Yeah, and I saw that on IMDb. I was like, damn.
Yeah, no. Last thing I did was a short film. It was about 6 years ago. Now acting is an interesting, you know, thing. That's lower. I will get an agent out here. I am going to do my own commercials for Bolitor and act in my own commercials for my company.
Yeah, that's sweet.
That's one less actor I have to pay and worry about, and I know how I want the dialogue delivered. And I fit the avatar of the talent and the customer. So that's
checking
cool.
All the boxes. Yeah. Also imagine the trust for the brand seeing like the founder in the commercial. Like I bet that's just all around wins.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a weird thing too. It's like in the past, you're like, oh, you're the owner, be quiet. You know, don't, you know, this is like in the '80s or whatever. Now everybody's like, who owns this company? I want to know what do they stand for? What's their mission? You know, you always see that like the About Us page.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really big in my generation. I was looking up, I'm like fascinated on generational differences, like why there are these like big splits. It's really interesting. But I noticed for Gen Z, their big thing joining in the workforce and the career is they have to feel number one, fulfilled. And number two, it's like where they're working and spending their time aligns with who they are. So I feel like that's just leads to a lot of like, what's your company about? What are you doing? What, like that kind of thing.
Right. Agreed. You know, and I like Gen Z actually, you know, every generation is silly. I don't know if there's so much belief in like, you know, it's like horoscopes. I don't know if I believe all the differences.
This is to me, this is the part that I agree with, because I'm very big on like what imprints you in your adolescence, and like the kind of stamp you get as a child impacts you your whole life. And what I've noticed is a lot of the cause of generational differences is the global events going on during this imprinting phase. So like, let's say COVID to a, you know, to a middle schooler is gonna just like last longer than to me, who was like 23. I understand it was a really tough time, but like to me, the events I had were much different than the middle schoolers who literally lost like 2 years of their like social years in school. They weren't able to go to school. So that, I guess that's the part where I believe, but also it's like, we're all still people at the end of the day. Like it's not a,
I'm a typical Gen Xer, which is like, fuck it. I don't know. I don't care. I'm just going to keep on fucking going and just do my fucking job. And I don't care. I don't listen to shit.
I mean, that's my parents. Yeah, so
get it done. Right. They're Gen Z, right?
Oh, no, they're Gen X. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't fucking know. I just fucking just keep
it was
on going.
The generation Gen X was like, the joke was the generation where your parents would be like, "All right, come home when it gets dark." Latchkey kids. Yeah, they didn't give a fuck. Like your parents.
The day
didn't
I turned 16, I got my driver's license when I turned 16 years old. The day I turned 16, I went to Florentine Gardens, which is a dance club on Hollywood Boulevard, and I didn't get home until 2:30 in the morning. That's it, man. That's
there you go. Number. Drink water straight from the hose. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah, my mom was straight up, you know, cool. But like my dad, he was cool too. But he was like, I mean, did you see the movie Boogie Nights?
No, I haven't.
All right. Well, there's a character. Burt Reynolds plays a character. He's a porno director, and he has like crazy parties at a house and his lifestyle, and that's loosely based on my dad, there's nothing I could have done.
Was your dad the porn industry?
No, but he had notorious Hollywood like orgy parties that were just sheer carnality, that were just like out of control.
That's wild.
You know, and I'd go to like this greenhouse. It was called the greenhouse, where the artwork was green, the carpeting was green, he had a green Cadillac, the whole house was green. You'd walk in there and some shit went down there the night before, and I'd walk in there and I'd be like, dude, was there something happening here last night? And I'm like 13. Yeah, like you could feel like the rooms were still like vibrating, and like just like, I don't know, you know, and because you'd hear stories anyway, even though you're 13 years old, you hear shit.
Yeah,
but there's nothing that I could have done that I haven't already, you know, heard that my dad would do. So I was like, I was a good kid, you know, compared to him.
I mean, something to be said. I want to hear all about the imprinting that happened there, but I feel like that's a separate podcast. Yeah, that's not this show.
It's I don't know. I talk about it sometimes, but it's just a long story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, Michael, with that, we just have the closing questions to wrap up the show, and then we'll be good. So these are more like rapid fire, quick questions to get to know you better. First of all, what kind of music do you listen to?
I listen to a range of composers, film composers, rap and hip hop, which is my sweet spot. Even though a lot of people, I wrote, directed a documentary, produced a documentary and directed called Generation of Sound on the history of house music and raves. I don't listen to house music at all. Some people are like, you totally start talking about all about house music, but funk, hip hop, anything from Tony Bennett to Frank Sinatra to film composers to my 13 and 16 year old daughter's music. It just has to be good. I like something that, like, I don't know. I'm a big also like I don't go to concerts so much, but if John Williams, who's like the most prolific, you know, film composer,
did Star Wars.
He did a famous concert at the Hollywood Bowl. And, the kind of concert that it is that he would explain the music and then he would talk about the film. And I'll, maybe this would be a good way to segue out. Spielberg came up with the script for Schindler's List. And he says, we're finally going to do Schindler's List because it was going around for a decade.
Yeah.
And he said, look, you know the story?
Do you know the podcast Smartless?
No.
Have you heard that? I highly recommend it for you. So it's, do you know Will Arnett, Jason Bateman, and Sean Hayes?
Oh, is it that one?
Yeah, the three of them, they do a podcast together. They interview people in Hollywood, and they just all tell stories of acting, movies. And so they interviewed Spielberg on one of them. And it was to promote his recent movie last year, 2 years ago. I can't remember.
The Fablemans?
Yes. It was. They talked about the Fablemans, but they talk about how that was like the last John Williams Spielberg combo. Well, that we know of because John Williams is retiring. But he said Spielberg was like, of all my collabs, that's the greatest one I've ever had. Like, I highly recommend this episode at the very least. Like, they do a great job of, you know, ripping on each other, but then also really talking to these high end people. They've gotten, there's another one, Armchair Expert, that had Tarantino on. That was a really good, like, if you're a director, I think those are some really good podcasts to check out.
Yeah. Well, John Williams, I'm sad to hear that he's retiring, but when Spielberg said, I want you to do this, and Williams read the script and he says, I don't know if I can do this. I think there might be other composers that you can do that can do a better job because this is so intense at the time. He said that. And Spielberg says, yeah, there are, but they're all dead. Meaning like the great composers of like Mozart and Beethoven and what a great relationship between those two guys. So, as far as the music I like all kinds of music, but I do gravitate towards that.
Yeah. Oh, so here's what the Spielberg thing was. So he was talking, it's insane how prolific Spielberg is on, if you look at his list of movies, I was checking it out after this episode. I couldn't believe that one man did all these films, but he was talking about how Schindler's List came out the same year as another one of his really big films.
Jurassic Park.
That's right. And so what happened is he took a trip with his writing partner. I can't remember who the writer that he worked on Schindler's List is, but they took a trip to Auschwitz and all the concentration camps. They went throughout Europe. And then he went, when Jurassic Park was being wrapped up and the final editing, he went to George Lucas and said, hey man, like, I need you to finish this because this project's calling and I can't think of anything, but like, he came back from that trip and he was like, I need to stop everything and focus on Schindler's List. So that's how he did like the writing for it. But it goes to show, like, with a true artistic endeavor like that, he was finishing Jurassic Park. Like, he left someone else to finish the final edits and everything because he was like, this needs my everything, which was a fantastic story to hear.
I can't imagine that. I mean, these are just juggernaut films, those. I mean, everything's working out
like,
sick.
Like, Jurassic Park, E.T., he was just, like, trading. He was, him and George Lucas' friendship, they talk about it on the podcast, too. It's really funny how he saw, like, the first cuts of, how they did Indiana Jones and Han Solo. Like, they were talking about how Spielberg was just, like, on set of Star Wars. He's like, who's that guy? I think he should be Indiana Jones. He's like, that's my Han Solo. Like, that's kind of how it was. But it's crazy how these guys were just friends and they would help each other out. Yet they made, they're both, I don't know if Spielberg is a billion. I think he might be a billion. Like, they're both billionaires off of film. Like, that to me is nuts.
It's sick. And, you know, I mean, once again, maybe close on this. You know, everything's hardest in the beginning, right? And then you build momentum. You know, it's like you see like Spielberg, it's like, you know, the last film is like a culmination, and Lucas, these are culminations of like these, the, you know, I was talking about momentum to my 13-year-old daughter last night. She goes, "What's momentum again?" You know, I'm like, "Well, you should know that word." But anyway, because when you start pedaling a bike and it's really hard in the beginning, and then you put some work in, and then it gets, you know, going, and that momentum and whatever your project is, whatever you're doing, it's always going to be hardest in the beginning. But these guys built this like amazing careers to where fucking Spielberg can walk away from the end of like editing Jurassic Park and tell somebody else, "You take over it for now. I'm going to go film something else."
Yeah.
Because both of those guys have been pedaling for so long with momentum.
Yeah.
That it's just like, it's going to get done well. It's
and something important to note is momentum works both ways. If your momentum is in the sit and still version, like that's going to be just as even harder to start pedaling.
Quicksand.
All right. What kind of movies or TV shows do you like or have any recommendations for the audience?
Movies, you know, I mean, there's just so many. I can't, you know, I mean, so many movies. All I did was watch movies up until 2 years ago, 3 years ago. All I did was watch at least one movie a day since I was 14, you know, because I wanted that to be my life. So, you know, if you're a filmmaker, read and write and watch movies. Read screenplays, write screenplays, and watch movies.
Yeah.
I just recently got into TV shows, and I'm like told, you know, my kids are like, "Well, honestly, this 3 years ago or whatever." They're like, "Watch, want to watch Stranger Things?" I said, "I don't want to watch TV shows because I don't want to get caught up. It's going to take away from my film time." Mm. Let me tell you something about these TV shows, like Stranger Things and all that. They're fucking great now. Like
Game of Thrones, how it's like a 10-hour movie, a season like that. Yeah.
They're sick. The writing, direction, shot composition, the editing, everything is like incredible. And it's almost like, you know, I'm concerned that film has been, a big chunk of it has been taken out.
Yeah.
Because
I would agree with that. Yeah. And something to be said, that's one thing they talked to Spielberg about, actually, is like, would you ever do a TV show? He said one of his movies was actually supposed to be like a 3-episode series. Like it was supposed to be, instead of 2 hours, like 6 or 8 hours or something like that. And he said that he couldn't find the funding for that. And the main actor wasn't willing to do it. I can't remember. Fuck. It was Lincoln. I think it was Lincoln. He said Lincoln was supposed to be a series. But who's the act? I can't remember the guy who played Lincoln. He's like, "Yeah, I don't think he would have gone for like a 6 to 8 hour shoot. Like, I think he wanted just the movie." But so I totally agree. I like what you said. If you're a director, write screenplays, read screenplays, and watch movies. I would say the same exact thing applies to musicians. So I'm a bass player, and funk is my favorite genre, so I'm glad you said that's one of yours. But I'm a bass player, like, the best advice I was asking this guy, much more experienced than myself, "What can I do to be better?" I thought he recorded us a studio session. He was a producer. And I was like, how can I be better? I thought he was going to give me like, "Oh, study this in theory, do this, like change this." He's like, "Dude, just listen to random ass music." He said, "Listen to any kind of music you can. If something interests you, find the root, because all music comes from somewhere." So when I told him I like funk, he's like, "All right, listen to like Afro-Cuban reggae." Or something like that. He's like, oh, like, listen to all these different things. Try to pick apart the bass lines, and I bet you'll be a better musician. And I've been trying that. Yeah, it's so true.
Are you familiar with the Blue Note label?
No. What?
Okay, so familiar. I got into Blue Note label when I did my film, Rituals and Resolutions, which has a lot of like, so it's the late 60s. Blue Note label was made out of somebody's garage. The origins of funk basically can be argued that Blue Note label, you know, the Beastie Boys sample a lot of Blue Note label music.
Oh, is this like OG jazz and blues?
Yes.
Okay, sweet. I'll check in. Blues is another genre I really love, so I'll definitely look into this.
Yeah, it's just different than just blues. It's like it's its own. It's almost like its own genre. It's Blue Note. It's the gap between jazz and funk and hip hop. And anybody that's like a schooled, you know, funketeer will know what
blue. No, I get, I get, I also get what you mean by the gap, like how someone like Ray Charles was the gap between gospel and soul music. Like they say he was the one who birthed soul music because he turned gospel into something that was more, you know, not seen as very church-like at the time, like talking about sex and rock and roll and all this. So he kind of bridged that into its own thing. I get what you mean by some genres are like service stepping stones. Yeah. What kind of books are you reading right now?
Well, I'm so busy that I'm actually listening to books. I got a book right here. Somebody's on my podcast, The Habit Maniac. And my wife bought me a Don Rickles book for Christmas. So I'm reading that. And last year, I still got to finish up. She bought me the Beastie Boys book. I'm still looking at that. Those are the current ones I just need to finish up.
Yeah, sweet. Well, with that last question, where can people find you?
Longshotleaders.com, which just go there. You'll see my bio. If you got a long shot story, if somebody has overcome large obstacles to find success in any way, shape, or form, let us know. We want to have you on the show.
Sweet. All right, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure talking to you. This is one of the conversations that's going to energize me throughout the day. I really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thanks. I'm going to remember your story about when you practice with your brothers. I will be thinking about that tonight when I'm home.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Maybe have your daughters go out and boo you throughout. That'll help.
Not bad. Yeah. Think of creative. I want to think you guys really concentrate on creative heckling, scrutinizing. let's find those weak points. I love it.
All right. Have a great rest of your day, man.
You too.